news. Somebody got the story from a contact in the NYPD. It's going to be all over the afternoon papers. Can you imagine Wright's face when he sees that? Oh, God. Smithback cackled for a moment before filling his mouth again. He'd finished his own and was starting on Margot's. For a thin guy, he ate like a beast.
But how could there be a wild animal loose in the museum? Margot asked. That's absurd.
Yeah, well, get this. They've got someone in here with a bloodhound trying to track the son of a bitch.
No, you're joking.
Hey, not me. Ask any of the security guards. There's a million square feet in this joint where a big cat or something could be roaming, including 5 miles of forced air ducts big enough for a man to crawl around in. And under the museum is a warren of abandoned tunnels. They're taking it seriously.
Tunnels?
Yep. Didn't you read my article in last month's magazine? The first museum was built on an artesian swamp that couldn't be permanently drained. So they built all these tunnels to divert the water. Then, when the original museum burned down in 1911, they built the present museum on top of the old museum's basement. The sub-basement is huge, multi-leveled. Much of it isn't even electrified. I doubt if there's anybody still alive who really knows their way around down there.
Smithback munched the last piece of lasagna and pushed the tray aside.
And then there are the usual rumors about the museum beast.
Anybody who worked in the museum had heard that story. Maintenance men working late-night shifts saw it out of the corners of their eyes. Assistant curators wandering down dimly lit corridors on their way to specimen vaults saw it moving in the shadows. Nobody knew what it was or where it had come from, but some claimed the beast had killed a man several years before. Margot decided to change the subject. "Is Rickman still giving you trouble?" she asked. At the mention of the name, Smithback grimaced. Margot knew that Lavinia Rickman, the chief of public relations for the museum, had hired Smithback to write his book. She had also worked out the museum's cut of the advance and royalties. Although Smithback wasn't happy about the contractual details, the exhibition promised to be such a blockbuster that book sales, riding on the success of the exhibit, could easily climb into six figures. It hadn't been a bad deal for Smithback at all, Margot thought, given the only modest success of his previous book on the Boston Aquarium.
"Rickman? Trouble?" Smithback snorted. "Oh, God, she's the definition of trouble. Listen, I want to read you something."
He pulled a sheaf of papers out of a notebook.
"When Dr. Cuthbert pitched the idea for an exhibition on superstition to the museum director, Wright was very impressed. It had all the makings of a blockbuster exhibition, something on the level of the Treasures of King Tut or the Seven Levels of Troy. That meant big money for the museum, Wright knew, and an unparalleled opportunity to raise funds from corporate and government sponsorship. But some older curators were unconvinced. They thought the exhibit smacked of sensationalism."
Smithback stopped.
"Now look what Rickman did."
He pushed the paper over to her. A big line sliced across the paragraph, and a marginal note in fat red marker read, "Out." Margot giggled.
"What's so funny?" Smithback demanded. "She's butchering my manuscript. Look at this."
He jabbed his finger at another page. Margot shook her head. "What Rickman wants is a snow job for the museum. You two won't ever see eye to eye."
"She's driving me crazy. She's taking out everything that's the slightest bit controversial. She wants me to spend all my time talking to that nerd who's curating the exhibition. She knows that he'll only say what his boss Cuthbert tells him to."
He leaned forward conspiratorially.
"You've never seen such a company man in your life."
He looked up and groaned.
"Oh, God, here he comes now."
A young, slightly overweight man with horn-rimmed glasses materialized at their table, holding a tray balanced on a shiny leather briefcase.
"May I join you?" he asked shyly. "I'm afraid this is practically the only seat left in the house."
"Sure," said Smithback. "Have a seat. We were just talking about you anyway. Margot, meet George Moriarty. He's the guy who's curating the superstition exhibition."
Smithback shook the papers at Moriarty.
"Look what Rickman did to my manuscript. The only things she didn't touch were your quotations."
Moriarty scanned the pages and looked at Smithback with almost childlike gravity.
"I'm not surprised," he said.
"Why air the museum's dirty linen anyway?"
"Come on, George. This is what makes for an interesting story.
Moriarty turned to Margot. You're the graduate student working on primitive pharmacology, aren't you? He asked.
That's right, she said, flattered. How did you know?
I'm interested in the subject. He smiled and looked at her briefly. The exhibition has several cases devoted to pharmacology and medicine. I wanted to talk to you about one of them, actually.
Sure. What did you have in mind?
She looked at Moriarty more closely. He was about as average a museum character as she could imagine. Average height, a little pudgy, hair an average brown. His rumpled tweed jacket sported the heather tones that were regulation museum issue. The only things unusual about him were his large wristwatch, shaped like a sundial, and his eyes. An unusually clear hazel, shining with intelligence from behind his horn rims. Smithback sat forward, shifted irritably in his chair, and stared at the two.
Well, he said, I'd like to stay on and witness this charming scene, but I'm interviewing someone in the bug room on Wednesday, and I need to finish my current chapter. George, don't sign any movie contracts for that exhibition of yours without talking to me first.
He stood up with a snort and made for the door, threading a complex path between tables as he went. 8. Jonathan Hamm peered down the basement corridor through a thick pair of glasses that badly needed cleaning. Leather leashes were wrapped around his black-gloved hands, and two hounds sat obediently at his feet. His assistant tracker stood beside him. Next to the assistant was Lieutenant DaGosta, holding soiled, heavily creased blueprints, his two deputies leaning against the wall behind him. Police-issue pump-action Remington 12 gauges hung off their shoulders. DaGosta rustled through the blueprints.
Can't the dog smell which way to go? He asked irritably.
Ham let out a long breath.
Hounds. They're hounds. And they're not on a scent. They haven't been on a good scent since we began, or rather, they've been on too many scents.
DaGosta grunted, withdrew a sodden cigar from his jacket pocket, and began to raise it toward his mouth. Ham caught his eye.
Oh, yeah, said DaGosta.
He pushed the cigar back into his pocket. Ham sniffed the air. It was damp, which was good. But that was the only good thing about this little picnic. First, there was the usual stupidity of the police.
What kind of dogs are these? They'd asked. We wanted bloodhounds.
These were hounds, he'd explained. A blue tick hound and a black and tan coon hound. Given the right conditions, these hounds could track a lost hiker after a 3-foot blizzard. But these, thought Ham, weren't exactly the right conditions. As usual, the crime scene had been fouled up. Chemicals, spray paint, chalk, 1,000 people tramping in and out. Besides, the area around the base of the staircase had been literally bathed in blood. Even now, 18 hours or so after the crime, the smell hung heavily in the air, agitating the hounds. They first tried to follow the scent from the crime scene itself. When that failed, Ham suggested they cut for scent, making a perimeter loop around the crime scene, hoping to pick up the trail as it exited. The hounds had never been trained to work indoors. Naturally, they were confused. But it wasn't his fault. The police wouldn't even tell him if they were looking for a human or an animal. Perhaps they didn't know themselves.
Let's go this way, said DaGosta.
Ham passed the leashes to his assistant, who started walking ahead, the hounds nosing the ground. Next, the hounds had bayed up a storage room full of mastodon bones, and the paradichlorobenzene preservative that poured out when they opened the door had caused a half-hour delay while the hounds recovered their sense of smell. And that was just the first of a series of storage rooms full of animal pelts, gorillas in formaldehyde, a freezer full of dead zoo specimens, a whole vault full of human skeletons. They came to an archway with an open metal door leading onto a descending stone stairway. The walls were covered with a crust of lime, and the stairway was dark.
That must be the dungeon, one of the policemen said with a guffaw. This goes to the sub-basement, DaGosta said, consulting the blueprints.
He motioned to one of the officers, who handed him a long flashlight. The shallow stairs ended in a tunnel made of herringbone brickwork, its arched ceiling barely the height of a man. The tracker moved forward with the dogs, DaGosta and Ham behind. Two policemen came last.
There's water on the floor, said Ham.
So what?
DaGosta said.
If there's been any water flowing through here, there won't be any scent. I was told to expect puddles of water down here. It only floods when it rains, and it hasn't rained. Well, that's reassuring.
They reached a place where four tunnels came together, and DaGosta halted to consult the blueprints.
Somehow I thought you'd need to look at that.
Oh, yeah? Well, I've got a surprise for you. These blueprints don't cover the sub-basement.
When one of the dogs whined and began furiously sniffing, Ham came suddenly to attention.
This way, quick!
The dogs whined again.
They've got something. It's a clear scent. It must be. Look at their hackles rise. Keep the light up here. I can't see a blessed thing.
The dogs were straining, pulling forward, noses up and sniffing the air ahead.
You see? You see? It's an air scent. Feel the fresh air on your cheek? I should have brought the spaniels. They're unbeatable with an air scent.
The policeman slid past the dogs, one beaming his flashlight, the other carrying his shotgun at the ready. Ahead, the tunnel forked again, and the dogs lunged to the right, breaking into a trot.
Hold it, Mr. Ham. There might be a killer out there.
The dog suddenly broke into a deafening baying. The assistant cried,
Heel! Castor! Pollux! Heel, damn you!
The dogs lunged forward, paying no attention.
Ham, I need a hand here!
What's gotten into you?
Cried Ham, wading into the frantic dogs, trying to grab their collars.
Castor! Heel!
Shut them up!
He's loose!
Cried the assistant as one of the dogs bolted into the darkness. They rushed after the retreating sound of the dog.
You smell it?
Ham said, stopping short.
Christ, Jesus, you smell it?
A pungent, goatish odor suddenly enveloped them. The other dog was frantic with excitement, leaping and twisting and suddenly breaking free.
Pollux! Pollux!
Wait! Forget the fucking dogs for a second. Let's proceed with a little order here. You two, get in front again. Safety's off.
The two men pumped their shotguns. In the echoing darkness ahead of them, the barking faltered, then stopped. There was a moment of silence. Then a terrible, unearthly shriek, like the screeching of tires, leapt from the inky tunnel. The two police officers looked at each other. The sound ended as suddenly as it began.
Castor! Oh, my God, he's been hurt!
Get back, Ham, goddammit!
At that moment, a shape suddenly hurtled at them from the darkness, and there were two stunning blasts from the shotguns, two flashes of light accompanied by deafening roars. The rumble echoed and died in the tunnel, and there was an intense silence.
You fucking idiot, you just shot my hound.
Pollux lay 5 feet from them, blood pouring freely from his ruined head.
He was coming right at me,
began one of the officers.
Jesus Christ! Stole that shit! There's still something out there!
They found the other dog 100 yards down the tunnel. He was torn nearly in half, guts strung out in crazy patterns.
Jesus, will you look at that?
Ham said nothing. Just beyond the body, the tunnel branched. The group stopped, and DaGosta continued to stare at the dog.
Without the dogs, there's no way of knowing which way it went. Let's get the hell out of here and let forensics deal with this mess.
Ham said nothing. 9. Moriarty, suddenly alone with Margot in the cafeteria, seemed even more uncomfortable. So? Margot prompted after a brief silence. Actually, I really did want to talk to you about your work. He paused.
You did?
Margot was unused to anyone showing interest in her project. Well, indirectly. The primitive medicine cases for the exhibition are complete, except one. We've got this terrific collection of shamanistic plants and artifacts from the Cameroons we want to display in the last case, but they're badly documented. If you'd be willing to take a look?
I'd love to, Margot said.
Great! When?
Why not now? I've got some time.
They left the staff cafeteria and moved down a long basement hall lined with rumbling steam pipes and padlocked doors. One of the doors bore the label Dinosaur Storeroom 4, Upper Jurassic. Most of the museum's dinosaur bone and other fossil collections were stored here in the basement, since, she had heard, the great weight of petrified bone would cause the upper floors to collapse. The collection's in one of the sixth-floor vaults, Moriarty said apologetically, as they entered a service elevator. And I hope I can find it again. You know what a warren of storage rooms they've got up there.
Have you heard anything more about Charlie Prine? Margot asked quietly.
Moriarty shook his head. Not much. Apparently he's not a suspect, but I don't think we'll see him back here for quite a while. Dr. Cuthbert told me before lunch that he was severely traumatized.
He shook his head. What an awful thing.
On the fifth floor, Margot followed Moriarty along a wide passageway and up a flight of metal stairs. The narrow, labyrinthine catwalks that made up this section of the sixth floor had been built directly underneath the museum's long, pitched roofs. On either side were rows of low metal doors, behind which lay the hermetically sealed vaults of the perishable anthropology collections. In earlier times, a poisonous cyanic compound had periodically been pumped into the vaults to kill vermin and bacteria. Now, artifact preservation was handled with subtler methods. As the two threaded their way along the catwalks, they passed a number of objects stacked against the walls. A carved war canoe, several totems, a row of slitted log drums. Even with 1 million square feet of storage space, every square inch had been utilized, including stairwells, corridors, and the offices of junior curators. Of 50 million artifacts and specimens, only about 5% was on exhibition. The rest was available only to scientists and researchers. The New York Museum of Natural History consisted not of a single building, but several large buildings, connected over the years to form one sprawling, rambling structure. As Margot and Moriarty passed from one of the buildings into another, the ceiling ascended, and the catwalk became a branching corridor. A dim light filtered down from a row of dirty skylights, illuminating shelves filled with plaster casts of aboriginal faces.
God, this place is huge, said Margot,
feeling a sudden cold thrust of fear, glad that she was seven stories above the dark spaces where the little boys had met their deaths. Largest in the world, Moriarty said, unlocking a door stenciled Central Africa D2. He switched on a naked 25-watt bulb. Peering in, Margot could see a tiny room stuffed with masks, shaman's rattles, painted and beaded skins, and a group of long sticks topped by grimacing heads. Along one wall was a row of wooden cabinets. Moriarty nodded toward them.
The plants are in there. This other stuff is the shaman paraphernalia. It's a great collection, but Eastman, the guy who assembled the Cameroon stuff, wasn't exactly the most careful anthropologist when it came to documentation.
This is incredible, said Margot. I had no idea.
Listen, Moriarty interrupted. When we began researching this exhibition, you wouldn't believe the things we found. There are close to 100 anthropology vaults in this section alone, and I swear some of them haven't been opened in 40 years.
Moriarty was suddenly more confident and animated. Margot decided that if he dumped the tweed jacket, shed a few pounds, and swapped the horn rims for contacts, he could almost be cute. But Moriarty was still talking.
Just last week, we found one of only a couple of existing examples of Yucca Gear pictograph writing. Right next door.
As soon as I get time, I'll be writing a note for the JAA.
Margot smiled. He was so excited he could have been talking about discovering an unknown Shakespeare play.
She was sure that only a dozen readers of the Journal of American Anthropology would be interested, but Moriarty's enthusiasm was refreshing.
Anyway, Moriarty said, pushing his glasses up his nose, I just need someone to help me make sense of this Cameroon stuff for the display case write-up.
What do you want me to do? Margot asked, temporarily forgetting the next chapter of her dissertation. His enthusiasm was infectious.
That's easy, said Moriarty. I've got the rough script for the case right here.
He extracted a document from his briefcase.
See, he said, running a finger down the covering sheet. This sets out what, ideally, we want the case to say. We call it the storyline. All you have to do is flesh this out, plugging in a few of the artifacts and some of the plants.
Margot scanned the document. It was starting to sound a little more time-consuming than she'd anticipated.
How long do you think this will take, by the way?
Oh, 10 to 15 hours, max. I've got the accession listings and some descriptive notes right here, but we've got to hurry. The opening is just a few days away. Back came the memory of her next chapter. "Now, wait a minute," she said. "This is a big job, and I've got a dissertation to write." The dismay on Moriarty's face was almost comical. It hadn't even occurred to him that she might have other things to do.
"You mean you can't help?"
"Maybe I can squeeze it in," she murmured. His face brightened.
"Great! Listen, while we're on the sixth floor, let me show you some of the other stuff up here."
He led her to another vault and inserted a key. The door rasped open to a dazzling display of painted buffalo skulls, rattles, feather bundles, and even a row of what she recognized as raven skeletons tied up with rawhide.
"Jesus," Margot breathed.
"There's a whole religion in here," Moriarty said. "Wait till you see what we're putting on display. This is just the stuff left behind. We've got one of the best Sundance shirts anywhere. And look at this." He pulled open a drawer. "Original wax cylinder recordings of the Sundance cycle songs. Every one, recorded in 1901. We've put them on tape, and we're going to play them in the Sioux Room. What do you think? Great exhibition, huh?"
"It certainly caused a fuss in the museum," Margot replied cautiously.
"Actually, there isn't as much controversy as people seem to make out," Moriarty said. "There's no reason why science and entertainment can't meet as friends." Margot couldn't resist.
"I'll bet your boss Cuthbert put you up to that line."
"Well, he's always felt that exhibitions should be more accessible to the general public. People may attend this because they expect ghosts and goblins and a spooky show, and they'll get them. But they'll go away with more than you might expect. Besides, the show's going to generate a lot of cash for the museum. What's wrong with that?"
"Nothing," Margot smiled. She'd leave the baiting to Smithback.
But Moriarty wasn't finished. "I know the word superstition has a bad connotation in some people's minds," he said. "It smacks of exploitation. And it's true that some of the effects we're putting together for the show are, well, a bit sensational. But an exhibit called Aboriginal Religion just wouldn't sell, would it?"
He looked at her with mute appeal. "I don't think anyone objects to the title," Margot said. "I guess there are a few people who don't feel your ends are truly scientific."
He shook his head. "Just the crusty old curators and the crackpots, like Frock, for example. They chose the superstition exhibition over his proposal for one on evolution. So, of course, he doesn't have a good word to say about it."
Margot's smile faded. "Dr. Frock is a pretty brilliant anthropologist," she said.
"Frock? Dr. Cuthbert says he's gone off the deep end.
The man's bloody daft," he says.
Moriarty imitated Cuthbert's Scottish accent. The sound echoed unpleasantly down the dim corridors.
"I don't think Cuthbert is half the genius you feel he is," Margot said.
"Now, please, Margot, he's top rate."
"Not compared to Dr. Frock, he isn't."
"What about the Callisto effect?" Margot asked. "That's some of the most cutting-edge work being done today. Does he have a single speck of proof to back up his speculations? Have you seen evidence of any unknown monstrous species roaming the earth?"
Moriarty shook his head again, sending his glasses plunging dangerously down his nose.
"Theoretical hype. I mean, theory has its place, but it has to be backed up with fieldwork. And that sidekick of his, Greg Kawakita, just encourages Frock with that extrapolation program he's developing. I suppose Kawakita's got his own reasons, but it's pretty sad, really, to see a great mind take such a bad detour. I mean, just look at Frock's new book, Fractal Evolution. Even the title sounds more like a kid's computer game than science."
Margot listened with rising indignation. Perhaps Smithback had been right about Moriarty after all. "Well," she said, "considering my affiliations to Dr. Frock, I don't suppose you'd want me messing with your exhibit. I might add too much hype to the script."
She turned and walked briskly out the door and down the corridor.
Moriarty looked shocked.
Too late, he remembered that Frock was her major advisor. He danced after her.
"Oh, no, no, I didn't mean," he stammered. "Please, I was just, you know that Frock and Cuthbert don't get along. I guess I've picked up some of that."
He looked so horrified that Margot felt her anger fade.
"I didn't know they had that much of a problem with each other," she said, allowing Moriarty to stop her.
"Oh, yes, from way back. You know that ever since Frock came forward with this Callisto effect, his star has been falling in the museum. Now he's a department head in name only, and Cuthbert pulls the strings. Of course, I've just heard one side of the story. I'm very sorry, really. You will do the case for me, right?
On the condition, Margot countered, that you get me out of this maze. I've got to get back to work.
Oh, sure, sorry, Moriarty said. The gaff had brought back all of his shyness, and as they began retracing their way to the fifth floor, he was silent.
So, tell me more about your exhibition. Margot tried to put him at ease. I've heard a little about some fabulously rare artifacts that will be on display.
I guess you must mean the Cathoga tribe material, Moriarty said. Only one expedition has ever found any traces of them. The figurine of their mythical beast Mbun is, well, it's one of the centerpieces of the show, he hesitated. Or I should say it will be one of the centerpieces. It's not on display yet.
Really?
Margot asked. Isn't that waiting till the last minute?
The situation is kind of unusual, Moriarty replied. But listen, Margot, this isn't for public consumption. They had returned to the catwalks, and Moriarty led her down the long corridors, speaking low. There's been a lot of high-level interest in the Cathoga artifacts recently. People like Rickman, Dr. Cuthbert, even Wright, apparently. There's been controversy over whether the material should be included in the exhibition. Surely you've heard the stories of a curse on the figurine, that sort of nonsense?
Not much, Margot said.
The expedition that found the Cathoga material met with tragedy, Moriarty continued, and nobody's been near the stuff since. It's still in the original crates. Just last week, all the crates were taken from the basement area where they'd sat all these years and moved to the secure area. Nobody's had access to them since, and I haven't been able to prepare the final displays.
But why were they moved? Margot pressed.
They entered the elevator. Moriarty waited until the door had closed before answering.
Apparently the crates had been recently tampered with.
What?
You mean somebody had broken in?
Moriarty stared at Margot, his owlish face wearing its look of perpetual surprise.
I didn't say that, he replied.
He turned the key, and the elevator lurched downward. 10. D'Agosta wished with all his heart that the double chili cheeseburger in his stomach would disappear. Not that it was bothering him, yet, but it was an unwelcome presence. The place smelled like they all did. In fact, it stank. All the disinfectants in the world couldn't cover up the smell of death, and the vomit-green walls in the medical examiner's office didn't help things any. Nor did the large gurney, currently empty, sitting like an uninvited guest under the bright lights of the autopsy suite. His thoughts were interrupted as a large woman entered, two men following close behind. D'Agosta noticed stylish glasses, blonde hair escaping from under a surgeon's cap. The woman strode over and held out her hand, her red lipstick creased in a professional smile.
Dr. Zevich, she said with a crushing grip, you must be D'Agosta. This is my assistant, Dr. Fred Gross.
Zevich indicated a short, skinny man.
And this is our photographer, Delbert Smith.
Delbert nodded, clutching a 4x5 Deerdorf to his chest.
So, Dr. Zevich, you come here often?
D'Agosta asked, suddenly eager to say something, anything, to stall the inevitable.
NYME's my home away from home,
Zevich replied with the same smile.
My field is, how shall I put it, special forensics. For just about everybody. We do our thing and ship them back out. Then I read about what it all means in the papers.
She looked at him speculatively.
You've, seen this kind of thing before, right?
Oh, yeah, said D'Agosta. All the time.
The burger in his gut felt like a lead ingot.
Why didn't he think ahead? Remember what his afternoon schedule was before chowing down like a damned hog. That's good.
Zevich consulted her clipboard.
Let's see. Parental consent? Good. Looks like everything's in order. Fred, start with 5B.
She began slipping on latex gloves. Three pairs.
a mask, goggles, and a plastic apron. D'Agosta did likewise. Gross wheeled the gurney over to the morgue bank and slid out 5B. The indistinct shape under the plastic looked strangely short to D'Agosta, with an odd bulge at one end. Gross slid the cadaver and its tray onto the gurney, wheeled the cart under the lights, checked the toe tag, and locked down the wheels. He placed a stainless steel bucket under the gurney's outlet pipe. Zevich was fiddling with a microphone hanging above the body.
"Testing 1, 2, 3. Fred, this mic is totally dead."
Fred bent over the reel-to-reel.
"I can't understand it. Everything's turned on."
D'Agosta cleared his throat.
"It's unplugged," he said.
There was a short silence.
"Well," said Zevich, "I'm glad there's someone here who's not a scientist. If you have any questions or comments, Mr. D'Agosta, please state your name and speak clearly toward the microphone, okay? Everything goes on the tape. I'm just going to describe the state of the body first, and then we'll start cutting."
"Got it,"
D'Agosta replied tonelessly. Cutting. It was one thing when a dead body was just lying there at the scene, but when they started cutting into it, peeling the layers away, he'd never gotten used to that.
"Are we up and running? Good. This is Dr. Matilda Zevich and Dr. Frederick Gross, and the date is Monday, March 27th, at 2:15 in the afternoon. We are joined by Detective Sergeant..."
"Lieutenant Vincent."
"Lieutenant Vincent D'Agosta of the NYPD. We have here..."
Fred read off the tag.
"William Howard Bridgman, number 33A45. I am now removing the covering."
The thick plastic crackled. There was a short silence. D'Agosta had a sudden flash of the gutted dog he'd seen that morning.
"The trick is not to think too much. Don't think about your own Vinny. 8th birthday just next week."
Dr. Zevich took a deep breath.
"We have here a Caucasian male, a boy age about 10 to 12 years, height, well, I can't give a height for this one because it's decapitated. Maybe 4 feet 10 inches, maybe 5 feet. Weight about 90 pounds. This is very approximate. The state of the body is such that I can see no other identifying marks. Eye color and facial features indeterminate due to massive head trauma. No anterior wounds or marks on the feet, legs, or genital area. Fred, please sponge off the abdominal area."
"Thank you."
"There are an undetermined number of large lacerations proceeding from the left anterior pectoral region at a 190-degree angle downward through the costals, sternum, and terminating at the right anterior abdominal region. This is a massive wound, perhaps 2 feet long and a foot wide. It appears that the pectoralis minor and pectoralis major are separated from the external thoracic cavity, the external and internal intercostals are separated, and the body is eviscerated to a great degree. The sternal process has been split and the rib cage exposed. Massive hemorrhaging in the aortal. It's hard to see before cleaning and exploration. Fred, clean the edge of the thoracic cavity. The viscera that are clearly exposed and fully protuberant are the stomach, small and large intestines. The retroperitoneal organs appear to be in situ.
Sponge the neck off, Fred.
The neck area shows signs of trauma, some bruising, perhaps indicative of extravasation, possible spinal dislocation. Now for the head."
"Dear God."
In the silence, Fred cleared his throat.
"The head is decapitated between the axial process and the atlas. The entire occipital portion of the calvarium and half the parietal process have been crushed, or rather seemingly punched through and removed by means unknown, leaving a hole perhaps 10 inches in diameter. The skull is empty. The entire brain appears to have fallen out or been extracted through this hole. The brain, or what is left of it, is in a pan here to the right of the head, but there is no indication of its original position vis-a-vis the body.
It was found in pieces near the body, said DeGosta.
Thank you, Lieutenant, but where's the rest of it?
That's all there was.
No, something's missing. You got full scene of crime series for this?
Of course, said DeGosta, trying not to show his annoyance.
The brain is severely traumatized. The cerebrum is... Fred, bring me a number 2 scalpel and transverse speculum. The brain appears to have been severed at the medulla oblongata. The pons ferolei is intact, but separate. The cerebellum shows surface lacerations, but is otherwise intact. There's little evidence of bleeding, indicating post-mortem trauma. There's the body of Fornix attached. The cerebrum has been completely severed from the mesencephalon, and the mesencephalon has been bisected and... Look, Fred, there's no thalamoid region. And no pituitary. That's what's missing.
What's that? Asked DeGosta.
He willed himself to look more closely. The brain, sitting in a stainless steel pan, looked a hell of a lot more liquid than solid. He turned away.
Baseball. Think about baseball. A pitch, the sound of a bat.
The thalamus and the hypothalamus, the body's regulator.
The body's regulator, repeated DeGosta.
The hypothalamus regulates body temperature, blood pressure, heartbeat, and the metabolism of fats and carbohydrates. Also the sleep-wake cycle. We think it holds the centers of pleasure and pain. It's a very complicated organ, Lieutenant.
She looked fixedly at him, anticipating a question. DeGosta mumbled dutifully,
How does it do all that?
Hormones. It secretes hundreds of regulatory hormones into the brain and bloodstream.
Yeah, DeGosta replied.
He stepped back. The baseball soaring deep in the center field, the center fielder dropping back, gloves raised.
Fred, come over here and look at this, Zavich said sharply.
Fred bent over the pan.
It looks like... Well, I don't know. Come on, Fred,
Zavich coaxed.
Well, it looks almost like...
Fred paused.
Like a bite was taken out.
Exactly. Photographer! Delbert rushed forward. Get this. Looks just like when one of my kids takes a bite out of a cake.
DeGosta leaned forward, but he could see nothing special in the gray, bloody mess.
It's semicircular, like a human's, but it appears larger, more ragged than you'd expect. It will take sections. Let's test for the presence of salivase enzymes, Fred, just in case. Take this to the lab. Tell them to flash freeze it and microsection here, here, and here. 5 sections each. Stain at least 1 with eosinophil. Strain 1 with salivase activating enzyme. Anything else you or they can think of.
As Fred laughed, Zavich continued.
I am now bisecting the cerebrum. The posterior lobe is bruised, consistent with removal from the cranium. Photograph. The surface shows 3 parallel lacerations or incisions, approximately 4 millimeters apart, about 1/2 inch deep. I am parting the first incision. Photograph. Lieutenant, see how these lacerations start wide and then converge? What do you think?
I don't know, DeGosta said, peering a little closer. It's just a dead brain, he thought.
Long fingernails, maybe? Sharpened fingernails? I mean, do we have a homicidal psychopath on our hands?
Fred returned from the lab, and they continued working on the brain for what seemed an eternity to DeGosta. Finally, Zavich told Fred to put it in the refrigerator.
I will now examine the hands, she spoke into the microphone.
She removed a plastic bag from the right hand and carefully resealed it. Then she lifted the hand, rotated it, examined the fingernails.
There is foreign matter under the thumb, the index, and ring fingers. Fred, 3 well slides.
He's just a kid, DeGosta said. You'd expect his fingernails to be dirty.
Perhaps, Lieutenant, Zavich replied.
She scraped the material into small depressions in the slides, one finger at a time.
Fred, the stereo zoom, I want to look at this.
Zevich placed the slide on the stage, peered down, and adjusted the instrument.
Normal fingernail dirt under the thumb, from the looks of it. Same with the others. Fred, full analysis, just in case.
There was nothing of interest on the left hand.
I will now, Zevich continued, examine the longitudinal trauma to the anterior portion of the body. Tell photographs here, here, and here, and whatever else you think will show the wound best. Close-ups of the areas of penetration. It looks like the killer has done our Y incision for us, wouldn't you say, Lieutenant?
Yeah, DaGosta said, swallowing hard.
There were a series of rapid flashes.
Forceps, Zevich continued. Three ragged lacerations begin just above the left nipple in the greater pectoral, penetrating and eventually separating the muscle. I am opening and probing the first laceration at the point of entry. Clamp there, Fred. I am now probing the wound. There is unidentified foreign matter here. Fred, a glassine. It looks like clothing material, perhaps from the victim's shirt. Photograph.
The flash popped, and then she held up a small piece of what looked like bloody lint, dropping it into the glassine envelope. She continued probing in silence for a few moments.
There is another piece of foreign material deep in the muscle, about 4 centimeters directly below the right nipple. It is lodged on a rib. It appears to be hard. Photograph. Stick a flag in there, Fred.
She extracted it and held it up. A bloody lump poised at the end of the long forceps. DaGosta ventured forward.
What is it? Rinse it off, maybe, and see.
She glanced at him with a slight smile.
Fred, bring me a beaker of sterile water.
As she dipped the object in and stirred, the water turned brownish red.
Keep the water. We'll see if there's anything else in it, she said, holding her find to the light.
Jesus H. Christ, said DaGosta. It's a claw. A fucking claw.
Zevich turned to her assistant.
That will be a charming snippet of monologue for our tape, won't it, Fred?
11. Margot dumped her books and papers on the sofa and glanced at the clock perched atop the television. 10:15. She shook her head. What an unbelievable, horrible day. Staying all those extra hours had only netted 3 new paragraphs on her dissertation, and she still had to work on the display case copy for Moriarty. She sighed, sorry she'd ever agreed to the project. Reflected neon light from a liquor store across the avenue struggled through the lone window of Margot's living room, throwing the room into electric blue chiaroscuro. She turned on the small overhead light and leaned against the door, scanning the disorder slowly. Normally, she was neat to excess, but now, after just 1 week of neglect, textbooks, letters of sympathy, legal documents, shoes, and sweaters were scattered across the furniture. Empty cartons from the Chinese restaurant downstairs lay neglected in the sink. Her old royal typewriter and a fan of research papers were spread out on the hardwood floor. The shabby neighborhood, not yet gentrified Upper Amsterdam Avenue, had given her father another reason why she should return home to Boston.
"This is no place for a girl like you to live, Midge," he had said, using her childhood nickname. "And that museum is no place to work. Cooped up day after day with all those dead stuffed creatures, things in jars. What kind of life is that? Come back and work for me. We'll get you a house in Beverly, Marblehead. You'll be happier there, Midge. I know you will."
When she noticed her answering machine was blinking, Margot pressed the message button.
"It's Jan. I got back into town today, and I had just heard. Listen, I'm really, really sorry to hear about your father's death. I'll call back later, okay? I want to talk to you. Bye."
She waited. Another voice came on.
"Margot, this is your mother."
and then a click. She squeezed her eyes tightly for a moment, then took a deep breath. She wouldn't call Jan, not just yet. And she wouldn't return her mother's call either, not till tomorrow at least. She knew what her mother would say. You have to come home to your father's business. It's what he would have wanted. You owe it to both of us. Turning away, she settled herself cross-legged in front of the typewriter and stared at the curator's notes, catalog data, and accession listings Moriarty had given her. It was due the day after tomorrow, he'd said, and the next chapter of her dissertation was due the following Monday. She glanced at the papers for another minute or two, collecting her thoughts. Then she began to type. A few moments later, she stopped and stared into the dusk. She remembered how her father used to make omelets, the only thing he knew how to cook, on Sunday mornings.
"Hey, Midge," he would always say. "Not bad for an old ex-bachelor, eh?"
Several of the lights outside had been shut off as the shops closed. Margot looked out at the graffiti, the boarded-up windows. Maybe her father was right. Poverty wasn't much fun. Poverty. She shook her head, remembering the last time she'd heard that word, remembering the expression on her mother's face as she'd pronounced it. The two of them had been sitting in the cool, dark office of her father's executor, listening to all the complex reasons why her father's debt-to-equity ratio and lack of estate planning was forcing liquidation, unless some family member were to step in to keep his business afloat. She wondered about the parents of the two little boys. They must have had high hopes for their children, too, she thought. Now they'll never know disappointment or happiness. Then her thoughts moved to Prine and the blood on his shoes. She got up and turned on more lights. Time to start dinner. Tomorrow she'd lock herself in her office, get that chapter finished, work on the Cameroon write-up for Moriarty, and put off making a decision, for one more day at least. By next week's meeting with Frock, she promised herself she'd have made up her mind. The telephone rang. Automatically, she picked it up. "Hello," she said. She listened for a moment. "Oh, hello, Mother." 12. Night came early to the Museum of Natural History. As 5 o'clock neared, the early spring sun was already setting. Inside, the crowds began to thin. Tourists, schoolchildren, and harried parents streamed past the bronze lions and down the marble staircases toward the exits. Soon the echoes and shouts and clatter of footsteps in the vaulted halls died away. One by one, the exhibit cases went dark, and as the night wore on, the remaining lights threw crazed shadows across the marble floors. A lone guard wandered along a hall, making his rounds, swinging a long keychain and humming. It was the beginning of his shift, and he was dressed in the standard museum-issue blue and black guard uniform. Long ago, the novelty of the museum had worn off.
The whole joint gives me the creeps. Look at that son of a bitch in there. Goddamn native shit. Who the hell would pay to look at this stuff? Half of it's got curses on it anyway.
The mask leered at him out of a dark case. He hurried on to the next station, where he turned a key in a box. The box recorded the time, 10:23 p.m. As he moved into the next hall, he had the unsettling impression, as he had so often, that his echoing footfalls were being carefully duplicated by some unseen presence. He came to the next station and turned the key. The box clicked and registered 10:34 p.m. It took only 4 minutes to get to the next station. That gave him 6 minutes for a toke. He ducked into a stairwell, closing and locking the door behind him, and peered down toward the darkened basement, where another door opened to an interior courtyard. His hand went for the light switch at the top of the stairs, but then withdrew. No sense calling attention to himself. He gripped the metal handrail tightly as he crept downward. In the basement, he made his way along the wall until he felt a long horizontal handle. He pushed, and frigid night air streamed in. He wedged open the door and lit up a joint, inhaling the bitter smoke with pleasure as he leaned out into the courtyard. A thin light from the deserted cloister beyond gave a pale illumination to his movements. The faint hum of passing traffic, muffled by so many intervening walls, passages, and parapets, seemed to come from another planet. He felt, with relief, the warm rush of the cannabis, another long night made bearable. Smoke finished, he flicked the roach into the dark, ran his fingers through his crew cut, stretched. Halfway up the stairs, he heard the door slam shut below. He stopped, feeling a sudden chill. Had he left the door open? No. Shit, what if someone had seen him toke up? But they couldn't have smelt the smoke, and in the dark it would have looked just like a cigarette. There was a strange rotten odor in the air that had nothing to do with weed. But no light flicked on. No footstep sounded on the metal steps. He started up toward the landing above. Just as he reached it, he sensed a swift movement on the stairs behind him. He spun around, and a hard jerk on his chest shoved him backward against the wall. The last thing he saw were his shadowy entrails rolling and slipping down the stairs. After a moment, he stopped wondering where all that gore had suddenly come from. 13. Tuesday. Bill Smithback sat in a heavy chair, watching the sharp, angular figure of Lavinia Rickman behind her birchwood veneer desk, reading his rumpled manuscript. Two bright red fingernails tapped on the glossy finish. Smithbag knew that the fingernail tattoo did not bode well. A very gray Tuesday morning sat outside the windows. The room was not a typical museum office. The untidy stacks of papers, journals, and books that seemed a fixture in other offices were missing. Instead, the shelves and desk were decorated with knick-knacks from around the world. A storyteller doll from New Mexico, a brass Buddha from Tibet, several puppets from Indonesia. The walls were painted light institutional green, and the room smelled of pine air freshener. Additional curios were arranged on both sides of her desk, as formal and symmetrical as shrubs in a French garden, an agate paperweight, a bone letter opener, a Japanese netsuke, and in the center of the motif hovered Rickman herself, bent primly over the manuscript. The swirled, stiff orange hair, Smithback thought, didn't go well with the green walls. The tapping speeded, then slowed, as Rickman turned the pages. Finally, she flicked over the last page, gathered the loose sheets together, and squared them in the precise center of the desk. "Well," she said, looking up with a bright smile, "I have a few small suggestions."
"Oh," said Smithback.
"This section on Aztec human sacrifice, for example, it's much too controversial." She licked her finger daintily and found the page. "Here."
"Yes, but in the exhibition..."
"Mr. Smithback, the exhibition deals with this subject tastefully. This, on the other hand, is not tasteful. It's far too graphic." She zipped a magic marker across his work.
"But it's entirely accurate," Smithback said, wincing inwardly.
"I am concerned with emphasis, not accuracy. Something can be entirely accurate but have the wrong emphasis, and thus give the wrong impression. Allow me to remind you that we have a large Hispanic population here in New York."
"Yes, but how is this going to offend—"
"Moving on. This section on Gilborg simply must go." She zipped another line across another page.
"But why—"
She leaned back in her chair. "Mr. Smithback, the Gilborg expedition was a grotesque failure. They were looking for an island that did not exist. One of them, as you are so zealous in pointing out, raped a native woman. We were careful to keep all mention of Gilborg out of the exhibition. Now, is it really necessary to document the museum's failures?"
"But his collections were superb,"
Smithback protested feebly. "Mr. Smithback, I am not convinced that you understand the nature of this assignment." There was a long silence. The tapping began again. "Do you really think that the museum hired you and is paying you to document failure and controversy?"
"But failure and controversy are part of science, and who's going to read a book that—"
There are many corporations that give money to the museum, corporations that might very well be disturbed by some of this, Mrs. Rickman interrupted. And there are volatile ethnic groups out there ready to attack that might take strong exception.
But we're talking about things that happened 100 years ago, while...
Mr. Smithback! Mrs. Rickman had only raised her voice a little, but the effect was startling. A silence fell. Mr. Smithback, I must tell you quite frankly... She paused, then stood up briskly and walked around the desk until she was standing directly behind the writer. I must tell you, Mrs. Rickman continued, that it seems to be taking you longer than I thought to come around to our point of view. You are not writing a book for a commercial publisher. To put it bluntly, we're looking for the kind of favorable treatment you gave the Boston Aquarium in your previous, assignment. She moved in front of Smithback, perching stiffly on the edge of the desk. There are certain things we expect, and indeed that we have a right to expect. They are, she ticked them off on bony fingers, one, no controversy, two, nothing that might offend ethnic groups, three, nothing that might harm the museum's reputation. Now, is that so unreasonable? She lowered her voice and, leaning forward, squeezed Smithback's hand with her dry one.
No.
Smithback struggled with an almost overwhelming urge to withdraw his hand. Well, then, that's settled. She moved behind the desk and slid the manuscript over to him. Now there's one small matter we need to discuss, she enunciated very precisely. There were a few spots in the manuscript where you quoted some interesting comments by people close to the exhibition, but neglected to identify the exact sources. Nothing important, you understand, but I'd like a list of those sources. For my files, nothing more. She smiled expectantly. Alarms rang in Smithback's head.
Well, he replied carefully, I'd like to help you out, but the ethics of journalism won't let me.
He shrugged his shoulders.
You know how it is.
Mrs. Rickman's smile faded quickly, and she opened her mouth to speak. Just then, to Smithback's relief, the phone rang. He got up to leave, gathering his manuscript together. As he was closing the door, he heard a sharp intake of breath.
Not another.
The door hissed shut. 14. DaGosta just couldn't get used to the Hall of the Great Apes. All those big grinning chimps, stuffed, hanging out of the fake trees, with their hairy arms and hilarious realistic dicks and big human hands with real fingernails. He wondered why it had taken so long for scientists to figure out that man was descended from the apes. Should have been obvious the first time they clapped eyes on a chimp. And he'd heard somewhere that chimps were just like humans, violent, excitable, always beating hell out of each other, even murdering and eating each other.
Jesus, he thought. There must be some other way to get around the museum without going through this hall.
This way, said the guard. Down this stairway. It's pretty awful, Lieutenant. I was coming in at...
I'll hear that later, said DaGosta.
After the kid, DaGosta was ready for anything.
You say he's wearing a guard's uniform. You know him?
I don't know, sir. It's hard to tell.
The guard pointed down the dim stairs. The stairway opened onto some kind of courtyard. The body lay at the bottom, in shadow. Everything was streaked and splattered in black. The floor, the walls, the overhead light. DaGosta knew what the black was.
You, he said, turning to one of several policemen following him. Get some lights in here. I want the place dusted and swept for fibers pronto. Is the SOC unit on its way? The man's obviously dead, so keep the ambulance people out for a while. I don't want them messing things up.
DaGosta looked down the stairs again.
Jesus H. Christ, he said. Whose footprints are those? Some jackass just walked right through that pool of blood, it looks like. Or maybe our murderer decided to leave us a fat clue.
There was a silence.
Are those yours? He turned to the guard. What's your name?
Norris. Eric Norris. As I was saying, I... Yes or no?
Yes, but...
Shut up. Are those the shoes?
Yes. See, I was...
Take the shoes off. You're ruining the carpet. Fucking door shaker, DeGusta thought. Take them to the forensics lab. Tell them to seal them in a crime bag. They'll know what to do. Wait for me there. No, don't wait for me there. I'll call you later. I'll have a few questions for you. No, take the fucking shoes off right here.
He didn't want another prying on his hands. What was it about this museum? People like to go around wading in blood?
You'll have to walk over there in your socks.
Yes, sir.
One of the cops behind DeGusta snickered. DeGusta looked at him.
You think it's funny? He tracked blood all over the place. It's not funny.
DeGusta moved halfway down the stairwell. The head was lying in a far corner, face down. He couldn't see it all that well, but he knew that he'd find the top of the skull punched out, the brains floating around somewhere in all that gore. God, what a mess a body could be if it wanted to. A step sounded on the stairway behind him.
S.O.C.,
said a short man, followed by a photographer and several other men in lab coats.
Finally! I want lights there, there, and there, and wherever else the photographer wants them. I want a perimeter set up. I want it set up 5 minutes ago. I want every speck of lint and grain of sand picked up. I want trace cam used on everything. I want, well, what else do I want? I want every test known to man. And I want that perimeter observed by everyone. Got it? No fuck-ups this time.
DeGusta turned.
Is the crime lab team on the premises? And the coroner's investigator? Are they out for coffee and croissants?
He patted the breast pocket of his jacket, looking for a cigar.
Put cardboard boxes over those footprints. And you guys, when you're done, squeegee a trail around the body so we can walk without tracking blood everywhere.
Excellent.
DeGusta heard a low, mellifluous voice behind him.
Who the hell are you?
He said, turning to see a tall, slender man, wearing a crisp black suit, leaning against the top of the stairwell. Hair so blonde it was almost white was brushed straight back above pale blue eyes.
The Undertaker?
Pendergast,
the man said, stepping down and holding out his hand. The photographer, cradling his equipment, pushed past him.
Well, Pendergast, you better have a good reason to be here, otherwise...
Pendergast smiled.
Special Agent Pendergast.
Oh, FBI. Funny, why aren't I surprised? Well, how do, Pendergast? Why the hell don't you guys phone ahead? Listen, I got a headless, de-brained stiff down there. Where's the rest of you, anyway?
Pendergast withdrew his hand.
There's just me, I'm afraid.
What? Don't kid me. You guys always travel around in packs.
The lights popped on, and the gore around them was bathed in brilliance. Everything that previously appeared black was suddenly illuminated, all the various shades of the body's secret workings made visible. Something DeGusta suspected was Norris's breakfast was also visible, lying amidst a wash of body fluids. Involuntarily, DeGusta's jaw started working. Then his eye caught a piece of skull with the dead guard's crew cut still on it, lying a good 5 feet from the body.
Oh, Jesus, said DeGusta, stepping back.
And then he lost it.
Right in front of the FBI guy, in front of SOC, in front of the photographer, he blew his own breakfast. I can't believe it, he thought. First time in 22 years, and it's happening at the worst possible moment.
The coroner's investigator appeared on the stairs, a young woman in a white coat and plastic apron. Who's the officer in charge? She asked, sliding on her gloves.
I am, said DeGusta, wiping his mouth.
He looked at Pendergast.
For a few more minutes, anyway. Lieutenant DeGusta.
Dr. Collins, the investigator replied briskly. Followed by an assistant, she walked down to an area near the body that was being squeegeed free of blood. Photographer, she said, I'm turning the body over. Full series, please. DeGusta averted his gaze.
We got work to do, Pendergast,
he said authoritatively. He pointed at the vomit.
Don't clean that up until the SOC is finished with these stairs, got it?
Everyone nodded.
I want to know ingress and egress as soon as possible. See if you can ID the body. If it is a guard, get Ippolito down here. Pendergast, let's go up to the command post, get coordinated or liaised or whatever the hell you call it. And then let's return when the team is done for a look-see.
Capital, said Pendergast.
Capital,
thought DeGusta.
The guy sounded deep south.